You are tuned to Truth News Radio Australia on the 29th of November 2014. My name's Harold Fenton. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another show. In today's two-hour show, we will be covering questions about media and power. In the first hour, I'm going to bring you an extensive excerpt from a media conference that was given by John Pilger and journalist and professor Des Friedman. The title of the conference was The Contradictions of Media Power. Actually, that's the title of the book also by Des Friedman, who is professor of media and communications at the Department of Media and Communications and chair of Media Reform Coalition in the UK. A really interesting discussion between two very experienced journalists, and of course John Pilger, a great hero of mine who's been on this show, and they have some very, very important things to say in this talk. It's very, very important to understand, folks, that our society is shaped by the media. When we think about power, when we think about how is everything kept in line, how do the elites control society? Media is the key to it. People are completely mind-controlled, completely brainwashed by media. And we need to understand the mechanism of that to understand the mechanism of tyranny itself. And I, you know, recently played a clip from Aldous Huxley talking about methods by which people could be controlled. And of course, the media is central to that. And of course, in that speech that I played last week, Huxley talked a lot about hypnotic suggestion. And that, of course, is one of the key ways in which the media works, because the media in our society is a giant monolithic force where you have so many different brands, so many different platforms, but they all tend to say the same thing, and they tend to repeat certain memes over and over and over again. And that, of course, is the power of suggestion, especially when you get it from several different broadcasting networks. Of course, you do have arguments, you do have contradictions. That, of course, is part of the way the system works as well, and that is part of what we call the manufacture of consent. It is really hard sometimes to grasp the degree to which our society is controlled, because it is done in such a way that it really doesn't look as if it's deliberate, but that is part of its genius. And when you see that, when you recognize that, that's when you realize the real depth of the problem, is that certain people have gone to great trouble to disguise what they're doing and then to go about in wrapping you in an octopus of control that is just breathtaking in its scope. And you have to stand back from it. You have to look at it. You have to really open your eyes, and it's hard. I find continually I'm challenged by this. And continually I'm slapping myself in the face and I'm saying, is this real? Is this really going on? You know, what is the nature of this world we are living in? So that's all coming up shortly. Now, in the second hour, I have Rochelle McCready coming on. Rochelle McCready is a lawyer, and she's been on the show a number of times, hasn't been on for a while. One of the main foci of her work as a lawyer is helping people who are mentally ill, who have been co-opted or coerced or just downright abused by governments, by their own families, by the medical system, and are having their freedoms taken away from them and being forced into medication, being forced into what they call community service orders, where they are forced to take medications. And Rochelle will be talking about the problems in our law that enable people to be committed and to be put on these involuntary programs. And we'll also be talking about the broader questions of mental health in our society, and indeed, what is mental health and what is mental illness. We'll be going over a lot of the perennial questions there about mental illness. And of course, Rochelle is someone who understands the deeper problems and the deeper conspiracies in our society and the way in which the powers that be may often use definitions of mental disorder in order to simply silence people, whether it's actually purely a form of political control or it's just sometimes inconvenient to have people talking and doing things that are not comfortable with the mainstream, that are somewhat out of the mainstream. And it is possible to work out a definition and the statistical and diagnostic manual of mental disorders has already come up with all kinds of diagnoses that basically define people as having a mental illness if they conflict with the authorities. Anyway, that's all coming up in the second hour. But now I want to take you to this recent conference, the ABC of Media Power, Des Freeman and John Pilger. It is quite a long talk. We will squeeze as much of this as we can in, and I may break to make a few comments of my own. So, without further ado, bringing you the conference between John Pilger and Des Freeman. The event begins with Des Freeman talking a little bit about his book.
To start with, and I just wanted to say why I wrote the book. And there are just three reasons. One is because I wanted to highlight the importance of power. Because I cannot believe that you can have any serious discussion about the media without addressing power up front. And remember, this is a time when, for many commentators and journalists and academics, actually, there's less of a need to talk about power, allegedly, because of the new platforms and technologies that are allegedly decentralising and dispersing power. Remember, you know, I follow Rupert Murdoch on Twitter simply to get the gems of wisdom, like his one from a couple of years ago, which was, haven't you heard of the internet? No one controls the media or will ever again. The first thing was just to put media on the agenda. Second, it's not just any, I hope, understanding of media. It's also an understanding of media, of power, that's related to the control of the resources that are needed to operate inside the media. So it's not just about giant corporations, whether they're new or they're old ones, and therefore the questions of ownership and concentration that we need to address, but it's also about the whole series of connections as well that are hidden or simply taken for granted between the media and other elites. So it's about the ideologies that they hold in common, the sets of ideas that they propose. It's about the shared social and political environments that I try and describe in the book. It's about common views on things like terror, the environment, or whether there is an environmental crisis, about their understanding of democracy, immigration, racism, and so on. Shared ideas that I think helps explain a lot of the commercial mainstream media that we see. And I think the power to speak is very, which is the heart of the media's role, is not an equal one. If you have the backing of a venture capital fund or a mogul or a government, then you're going to be able to be heard by many more people than is allegedly the case, despite our formal freedom to say what we want. And I just think, therefore, this affects the nature of the speech that there is. It affects your attitudes towards gender and race, towards attitudes towards the poor or the celebration of wealth. And I just think, I mean, how many examples could we go through? But you just think about the absence of pro-independence voices in the recent Scottish referendum. You think of the lack of context. This is no accident. The lack of context in coverage of this summer over Gaza, where the struggle between Israel and the Palestinians is somehow seen as a sort of equal tit-for-tat between, you know, two equal sides. And you also think, and this is just my the latest bugbear, is the lack of humility of all those commentators who have the gall to attack someone like Russell Brand for not having the economic expertise to be able to talk about the need for radical change and revolution. I mean, we could go through many of these. So that's the second, is the actual, the kind of understanding of power. But the third one is the but, because John could talk about the corruption of power for hours, weeks, days and years, I guess. But I just, the main reason for writing the book was because I thought, in a way, I wanted just to try and go a bit further, and also because I'm not a pessimist. And if you just buy the media as a very powerful block full stop, then in a way we just give up and go home. And so for many people it's important to try and have another reading of power as well, because I don't think things are quite that simple. For most of us in this room, we know that not every coder, journalist, editor, tape editor, not newspaper editor, you know, not everyone sets out to tell lies or to be involved in propaganda. And actually, I think we should recognise the fact that the media sometimes have to struggle to enforce their legitimacy and their credibility on ordinary people who are, as we know increasingly, are suspicious of elites and suspicious of voices of authority who tell them what to think. We don't believe them. And so that's why the book was written, to try and get to grips with what I see as this problem, that the media are this powerful bloc, but also they run up against rebellions, refusals, resistance on the part of ordinary people. So I just wanted to end my 1 minute just by reminding us of some of the cracks that are there, by drawing on John to a certain extent. I mean, how is it? I still don't know. You're going to tell us, I hope. How you managed to get some of the front covers. And these aren't marginal. These aren't the things that are buried in Channel 4 at 3 in the morning. This is the front cover of the Daily Mirror, which at the time sold, what, 4 million copies? The coverage of Cambodia. As far as I know, that was an issue which sold out. But also we have more recently, you know, the coverage of East Timor. I mean, this is recent history. Now, if you haven't seen it, this is real. I did not Photoshop any of this. These are real covers with John's name on that one. I can't remember if you wrote that or not. During the war on Iraq. This is consistent anti-war campaigning. And this is my favourite, the very subtle mirror front cover. you couldn't have done a better job with that. Now, the fact is that those pictures, they're not there, these covers, because of an inherent liberalism inside the media, or an easy diversity in media markets. They're there because I think capitalism, and through foreign policy struggles away, it's riddled with contradictions that are reinforced and acted on by ordinary people, and that we shouldn't forget the fact that we deserve and we struggle for good hospitals, good, decent education, decent jobs, decent housing. Why should we not struggle also for decent representations and decent stories about the world that try and tell the truth which is so often buried? So that's a long way, sorry, of saying that actually if you see power in terms of the distribution of resources inside the media, then I guess rather shamefully and unobjectively just try and use the book to argue for a redistribution of those resources to produce a media that actually befits all of us in this room. Thank you very much.
And we're just going to break with Truth News Radio Australia, and I'm playing to you here some clips from a joint speech that was given by Des Freeman and John Pilger recently in the UK about the media and power. And we'll be continuing with that when we come back from the break. Don't go away. Men and women of Earth, may I have your attention? This is Hereward Fenton, host of Truth News Radio Australia. You're invited to join the info war as we work to restore truth in media and challenge the dark forces which now dominate mainstream news. I'm calling on you, valued listener, to use your hard-earned dollars to help us smash the globalist empire. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe today. Welcome back, you're with Truth News Radio. And I'm bringing you a speech today by Des Freeman and John Pilger titled The ABC of Media Power. really interesting speech, really interesting discussion and question and answer session. The next part we'll be playing to you is John Pilger's introduction. So I'll just continue with that, and then we'll be breaking for ad breaks. But I'll try and squeeze as much of this as we can into hour one of today's show. And, of course, don't forget in hour two, a great interview coming up with Rochelle McCready, human rights lawyer.
I mean, Des is absolutely right to analyse media power. The whole essence of media is not about information, it's about power. The power of the media is the most formidable power in our society. It's become far greater than when those front pages were published. One of them 1979, the other something of an aberration in 2003, and briefly the Daily Mirror supported the anti-war movement against the invasion of Iraq. So, but today the media is, as the father of propaganda, modern propaganda, Edward Bernays, described, an invisible government. It's a government that is in the government, is in the government's vested interests, it's in the media. The Prime Minister is a PR man by trade, not a very good one, but a PR man. That's all he is. That's all he is. He shouldn't be taken seriously except for he has a position. That position allows him certain aspects of the power in this country. But the real power resides in propaganda and in media. That's true now all over the world. And I don't, perhaps Des and I might disagree in that, I don't think it's about being optimistic or pessimistic. It's about recognizing a reality. Yes, the media isn't, no, the media isn't a monolith. And yes, there are cracks. And perhaps the only truth tellers are the honourable exceptions to a rule. I actually think that applies in the Academy as well. Des is a very unusual person in the Academy. I don't have a huge amount of time for the teaching of journalism, although I'm closely associated with an excellent journalism school, I must say, at Lincoln University, which has all my archive. And it has it because they too are exceptional, just as Des and the people here at Goldsmiths have always been exceptional. That's not true at quite a number of universities that simply provide fodder for a media machine. I've been in some media schools and spoken to the heads of journalism, and it really has been like speaking to the editor-in-chief of the News of the World. So I think we have to regard the teaching of journalism as well as the practice of journalism as part of the same monolith of power. Now, as I say, this is not simply a pessimistic view. It's the reality of what power is in the media. I'll give one example before I think I hand over to a Q&A, and that is that in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, the journalism played a very, very critical role in ensuring that invasion took place, especially in the United States, which has constitutionally the freest press in the world. Now, in discussing this with a number of very distinguished colleagues in the United States and in this country following the invasion, they were unanimous in saying that had journalists in responsible positions both in television and in newspapers, especially television, because of its power, have they questioned the deceptions? Have they challenged them? Have they done their job as journalists? Have they, as Dan Rather of CBS said, asked the critical second question instead of amplifying and echoing the lies that were told as pantomime? You'll remember Colin Powell before the United Nations, a pantomime act. All of it lies. All of it. Had they done that job, they believed that that invasion might not have taken place. Now, that may well be an optimistic view, but the fact that they were saying that, and these are people from well inside the media establishment on both sides of the Atlantic, saying that had journalists done their job, that invasion might not have taken place and hundreds of thousands of people would be alive today. That's the power of the media.
Okay, I'll just pause it there. The next section of the conference is actually a Q&A section and has a lot of interesting content and discussion in it. So we will be returning to that after the next break. I just want to take this opportunity to really emphasize the importance of this question of power, because the show you're listening to is an example of a media that is being brought to you with the intent of simply bringing you the truth. But it has very little power. It has very little reach. It has very little ability to make a difference in the world. And why is that? Well, it just doesn't have power behind it. You see, in order to have power, you have to have power behind you. So when we think of these large media organizations and we're amazed at how much power they have and how they're able to influence people. Well, that's simply a function of the fact that they were created in the beginning by very powerful people. A lot of money was put in to these organizations to allow them to become powerful. So power begets power. But there is a tendency within society, and I think it's a deep, innate tendency in human nature, to believe that those who have the power must be right. I think it comes actually from our childlike state as we grow up to look to the parent, to trust the parent, to trust the most powerful voice. From an evolutionary point of view, it makes sense. Children have to be educated. Human children take many years to mature, and they need the guidance of parents. It's not like that with other animals. Most other animals mature very, very quickly and become adult within 1 or 2 years. I mean, humans take a good 15 years. I mean, to be able to function, and that's still considered very young in our modern society. But you don't reach puberty till the age of 12 or 13. So we have this innate tendency to trust those who are bigger and stronger than us. So on that note, may I invite you to become a subscriber to Truth News Radio Australia, because we need to become bigger and stronger. And if we become bigger and stronger, people may trust what we say, our scope and our reach may increase. It's a very simple formula. At the moment, I've got less than 50 subscribers to this show. I would like to get to 500. And I'm asking you as a listener, can you help me get to that number? Maybe if you're already a subscriber, you could talk to your friends. Maybe you could take out a gift subscription, which is something I just launched on the site. You can actually go on the site and you can create a gift subscription for a friend, and we will email the login and account details and send the t-shirt to their account, to their address. Anyway, we are just going to break. We'll be right back. It's great talking to you today, and I'll be continuing with the speech by John Pilger and others. We'll be right back. Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. And I'm bringing you some clips from a conference featuring Des Freeman and John Pilger titled The ABC of Media Power. And we're just going into the Q&A section now. So I will continue with that. And we'll be playing that mostly for the rest of the first hour of today's show. And in the second hour of today's show, do stay tuned for a very interesting interview with Rochelle McCready, a human rights lawyer working in Australia with mentally ill people. So we're just going into the Q&A section of the event here, and the first question is to John Pilger.
John Danson, journalist, hello, pleased to meet you. And what do you think has been the most effective story you've ever done, and what's the biggest regret?
Oh, I don't think it comes down to one. I think degrees of effectiveness, quite a few ineffective ones, I have to say, that I thought might be effective. I mean, I'm not sure how we judge effectiveness. I suppose I would judge it by whether I had evidence that the disclosures in the story reached a large number of people and caused a debate, had a reaction. That wasn't a passive reception, that it had a reaction amongst people. Certainly the Cambodia stories had a pretty big impact. So that's, for me, that's what journalism is about. It's the old maxim of information is power. You do your best to give people that power. Because without that power, nothing changes. So it's providing that information and having some evidence that it's caused a debate, it's caused discussion, and perhaps it's even led to some change.
Has it been a struggle for you to get...
Yes, yeah. Big struggle. Mm. Yeah. Anthony Hayward has written a book pretty well, it's about the struggle I've had over the years to simply maintain a position in television. And I'm amazed when I read it. I'd forgotten most of it, as you try to forget all these battles, but he's researched them and struggles with various authorities over Ireland when we weren't supposed to really do anything on Ireland. And many others. Yes, it's a struggle, but that's really should be part of journalism. If there isn't a struggle, and you're working within a system that is inherently hostile to truth-telling. And I don't say that as satire, I mean that. It is hostile to truth-telling. One only has to see the media reaction to the truth-tellers, Edward Snowden, Julian Assange, the bitter reaction of people who shamed much of the media almost at a stroke. So, yes, there's always a struggle within it. That's not to say that there are numerous honourable exceptions. Whether or not they can make their voices heard or demonstrated through their work effectively is another thing.
Des, can I ask you to respond to that? How you think media power then encloses those debates in particular ways, and whether you think it's got any worse in recent times?
Well, it's a struggle for every journalist to get a story told, but obviously the perspective that you're adopting is going to be a little bit easier to sell should it not ruffle any feathers, should it be much more to the pleasure of your editor. And the fact is now, you just look at where the centre is. The centre just seems to keep moving towards the right. So if you're going to frame your story over whatever an issue it is, let alone immigration, then it's not a level playing field. You think of austerity now. There is so much capacity for important truth-telling around austerity, not least because the public's views on austerity should be represented. The latest figures are something like 46% of people think that there either wasn't a need for austerity or think that it's gone too far. Now, I defy you to find a media outlet that adequately reflects that point of view. I mean, the few academic studies that have been on this show that, you know, that significant, but it's almost the majority, is not reflected. And so this is partly, you know, it's the impact of the Murdochs making their presence felt, that this is not the kind of, you know, an anti-austerity story is not what's going to get you promotion. It's the role of advertisers as well. But again, it's just a shared ideological view which permeates so many of the institutions that makes it hard for those journalists who want to, you know, ask the tough questions and ask the second question. It makes it very hard to do. And I'm sure there are journalists, I assume there are lots of journalists in this room who are constantly frustrated. They're not brainwashed, but how easy is it to get that story out? And there are different levels of systems that just prevent that taking place.
It's very important, though, isn't it, Des, that young journalists are encouraged to get that story out. But they don't fall victim to the idea of that a certain cynicism about a people ordains them as journalists, as so often they're taught, rather than a scepticism about the system. Those two are often confused at a very early stage with young journalists, particularly idealistic young journalists who come up against a system where they realise that there is something called a censorship by omission. You leave out. You don't really discuss what you leave out, but it's left out. And the encouragement is so important for young journalists like that they are encouraged to navigate through the system. They are encouraged to stand up wherever possible they can, not all the time, but that individual, that individual sense of themselves as journalists, not as simply part of a system, is a critical part of a navigation that not always succeeds, but certainly doesn't fail in a wholesale way, as so much of journalism demonstrates as a failure. I mean, Des mentioned the austerity. That's a very, very good example. If you look back to 2008, you might remember the stories on BBC News and all over the papers. The banks were suddenly crooks. You know, when Northern Rock collapsed, the banks were crooks. RBA, they're all crooks. They're all exposed. The Guardian was full of tombstones of copy about how the banks were rotten from inside. It was the story, a glimpse. That story ended after about 3 months, and it was turned around that it wasn't really the banks. Yes, we had stories about how those who were the head of the banks had ripped off and had very large bonuses and so on. But it all came down to a national debt and a kind of controlled narrative, if I'll use what almost sounds dead like an academic term. A controlled narrative, you know, was there, and it's called austerity. And that debt had to be paid off. Why? Why did it have to be paid off? And the people that you quote, that's a majority, really. I mean, if you're getting that in a poll, 46%, that's a majority of the people, proving again that most people are ahead of the media. They usually are. They're ahead of the media as far as going to war. They're ahead of the media in terms of the economics of their lives, how they live. So we saw a glimpse of the truth that this massive criminality, and that's what it was, Wall Street right across to the City of London.
Okay, we're just going to break you with Truth News Radio Australia, playing to you from a speech there by John Pilger and media professor Des Freeman. More when we come back from the break. Stay tuned.
Happens in terms of creating wars is a mind manipulation technique called problem reaction solution. And it works like this. First of all, you create the problem, but you get someone else to be blamed for it. You then report that problem through the media in the way you want it reported. You get the public to react to your problem by saying something must be done, this can't go on, what are they going to do about it?
Hi, with Truth News Radio Australia. Today I'm bringing you a speech by John Pilger and Des Freeman. John Pilger, of course, well known to our listeners, a great journalist, made some amazing films, and has been a guest on this very program. Des Freeman is a media professor, and I'd just like to put a disclaimer on some aspects of what Des Freeman said when he indicated that the media had gone into a bias towards the right, which was in the earlier clip there. To me, that actually reveals his own bias and tendency to fall into this left-right paradigm thing. The media does sometimes have a right bias, it sometimes has a left bias, and both are completely controlled, completely artificial, and really have nothing to do with real issues in our society. It is a false construct. I mean, we've seen it in the United States with Fox News. You know, it is the faux right, and of course CNN is the faux left, and it creates this big kerfuffle between the brainwashed sheeples who go along with the right-wing views and the brainwashed sheeples who go along with the left-wing views. And, of course, this keeps everyone at each other's throats. This actually prevents real unity from developing because we all have shared values. Now, there is a real problem, though, I think it's in the degree to which people have become so brainwashed by the power groups to which they adhere to, by the sort of tribal allegiance to which they belong, that they actually go along with the lies and deceptions of their own group. For example, people on the who follow the right-wing point of view tend to think, you know, austerity measures are good because people should pull their socks up and the government shouldn't be taking care of you, right? This is kind of a meme that people who belong to a certain social milieu latch on to. And, of course, people on the left fall into all of the paradoxical, complete mind warp about things like climate change, also to exonerating Obama when he's been so clearly involved in so many treacherous foreign policy decisions and drone strikes and support of Israel and so many different things like that. There is a tendency to fall in line with the power group to which you belong, and, of course, the media makes it comfortable for you to do that because when you tune to your channel, you get reinforced in your beliefs and you get encouraged to go along with the little lies and white lies and not-so-white lies of the power elites who are pushing one particular agenda. So this is something very important that we need to establish now for those who want truth, for those who want truth in media, truth in journalism, is we do not subscribe to the left-right paradigm at all. Don't use it. Of course, it's very tempting. It's very tempting to blame the left, blame the right. This is a meme that has been given to you by those who want to control you. Anyway, let's continue now with the Q&A session from the speech here, and we'll be going on with that till the end of the hour. And any thoughts you may have on this, I'd be very interested to know. So please get back to me. I think it's been an interesting little discussion.
Subprime lending, hedge funds, all the rotten architecture had collapsed, almost collapsed, not quite, was picked up by the government, and banks were nationalised. Banks were nationalised without any conditions. Extraordinary. Off they went. A few conditions, but not many. The Bank of England remained privatized. Nothing changed. So the consciousness of how this happened, which was there for, I suppose, about 6 months, was, thanks to a very effective propaganda system, shifted that it wasn't the bank's fault, it was our fault.
Let's take another question.
Thanks. Actually, both partially answered the question I was originally going to ask, which was really about, whether the journalist saying, if only we'd asked the right questions, the Iraq war might not have happened, for example. And I was going to ask whether you felt that was kind of almost a sort of a collective, unconscious decision by journalists, or whether there was a larger power somewhere behind the scenes, leading them to that conclusion. You've kind of touched on that by saying it's easier to get a sell your story if you're playing through up to the right message. But being that I haven't read Des's book yet, but hope to, yes. But some of the argument here seems to be that the power really now is not with governments, and you talked about the Prime Minister not being the real one with the power. Where do you have any sort of insights as to really why the power of the media might be a sort of leading government policy in a certain direction, or at least sort of pushing particular agendas that you can't immediately see how those might be aligned with the media's interest per se, but seem to be sort of maybe aligned to something that none of us really quite understand. Have I framed that?
John.
I mean, there's no conspiracy. Doesn't have to be. There are shared assumptions. And those assumptions run very, very deep. Whereas a few years ago, more than a few, I would think a challenge to those assumptions came in from the margins, briefly. I would say we're talking about the 1960s and 70s. And that came into the media. If you look back on some of the newspapers then, even newspapers that are called right-wing newspapers now, you will find a recognition of certain struggles, of certain of the rights of the majority, if I can oversimplify it. You will find that in the newspapers, because it was then considered respectable by the right wing. That has moved back. It's gone. And as Des says, I don't like using the terms of left and right in terms of the media, because there isn't any left. I know that's amusing, but I don't say it for effect. There just isn't. And it's about time people stop using the term. You can use it historically, or you could use it in terms of one's own feelings and political leanings, if you wish, but there is no left in terms of media. There are gradations of it, though certainly it's just a denial of reality to say there is. And when The Guardian talks about the right-wing press, I'm amused, as if The Guardian is not a part of the right-wing press, but of course it is.
Okay, I'm just going to leave it at that point because I want to actually make a point about what John Pilger just said, which is very similar to the point I was making earlier, although he has framed it differently, and perhaps he's framed it in a way that is more palatable to people who consider themselves to be of the left. I believe that John Pilger understands that the left-right paradigm is essentially fake. I think there's a bit of a problem in the way he describes it there as simply being, everything is now all right, because and the left isn't represented anymore in media, because what that fails to take account of is that there are certain issues which have become adopted by the faux left and certain issues which have become adopted by the faux right, and that these issues then vie against each other and actually work as a mechanism to keep people in conflict with each other. I mean, say, take abortion. Abortion is a classic issue of the faux right versus the faux left. I mean, I believe it is somewhat engineered to be that type of a problem. And I've discussed this before, although I haven't really done a show on it, but you know, the question about abortion is always highlighted to bring people at loggerheads with each other rather than to try and understand what is the essence here, what is the essence of the debate. Gay marriage is another one. You know, gay marriage, greatly lauded by the left, greatly opposed by the right. There are so many of them. They're the little hot-button issues which serve to keep people in their boxes and prevent the coming together that needs to happen in response to really big issues, like, say, the corruption of the banks. And that is something that people either of the faux left or the faux right can certainly agree on. And there is no disagreement among the people on these major, major topics. And the invasions of countries that have taken place since September 11, 2001, again, the vast majority of people are totally opposed to the obvious rampant militarism, the obvious power grab that was taken by the US empire in all of these invasions that took place and the continuing destabilizations of other countries. So I would love to get John Pilger back on this show to talk about this very, very specific question of left versus right or faux left versus faux right. And, you know, before we decide to simply throw it all out and not talk about it anymore, I would actually like to talk about what these things actually represent and how they are actually being used as mechanisms of control. Anyway, I do hope you enjoyed that. We are now going to break. The second hour of the show is going to be a really interesting interview with Rochelle McCready. We're going to be talking about very important issues of mental health, the way in which your rights are intruded upon by mental health legislation. And we're going to go a little bit beyond what you may normally think of as being, you know, part of this problem, because people, the definition of mental health is very, very flexible in when it's held by the government. So we'll be right back after the news break. Do stay with us.